Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. Before I get started in on today's podcast, a quick little note. My ultrasound education company, Practical Pocus, will be having some upcoming courses that are open for registration. Please check it out at practicalpocus.com. We have two two-day courses that are coming up. They're both worth 16 hours of CME. It's a great deal. There are early bird registration discounts right now. Please go there soon. There are not many seats. We also do courses at individual facilities. If you want your whole group to get training or a portion of your group that does not already have it, please contact us through the website, practicalpocus.com, so you can get that education, because this is going to be a great opportunity. We have amazing educational speakers who want to provide content and train your people. And this is a unique opportunity, if you have not already been to Missouri, to just come. We have a course that's right in St. Louis and then one a little ways down the road in Rolla, Missouri. And this would be a nice way to take a little trip and learn some great stuff. And basically, this is something that, hey, try it out, learn it. If you have not had a great, solid educational course before, there will be lots of hands-on time. And we hope that you will join us there again. Early bird registration right now, huge discounts. Check it out. It's not going to last long, and there are only a few seats available. But let's get into what you have actually come here for today. When I have been working on stuff recently, we've had some wonderful feedback as of late, and I appreciate that. Anytime you get feedback, it's really helpful, because now we can adjust things to go where we want to go and cover topics that people have been asking about. And we've had some people who have really enjoyed the last few podcasts, particularly the hyperkalemia and dry drowning talks. Those were extremely popular. I think a big part of that is just because it's Michelle Perkins. But those are key topics that people want to know about. And we're going to have some more coming up. But the one that I'm talking about today is one that was also specifically requested, like some of the others as of late. And that is to have a little more discussion about intraosseous or IO devices. These are traditional devices that we see, and they're in most areas that do resuscitation. They're in our EDs, and sometimes they're even in the ICU type settings. They're in the pre-hospital setting too. And it's very important, because these devices traditionally have been used in the initial stages of resuscitation when peripheral intravenous access, you know, IV access, was not readily available. And that's something that it can happen for all sorts of reasons, you know, bad edema, burns, just large patients, IV drug users who've used up their veins, you know, all these are different things. And yeah, we could use ultrasound to do this. In fact, I use ultrasound a lot when I can in resuscitations to get that peripheral central venous access. But even more rapid than getting the ultrasound machine and pulling up to the bedside and finding that vein and then cannulating that vein, even faster than that, is to give an IO. Now, given the IO is not going to last as long as these other devices, but it is something that we can do extremely quick, because if we can't even get past the initial stages of resuscitation, what matters about that ultrasound guided line if that's not what's going to save them in the meantime? So this is one time where I'm going to say, yes, I love using ultrasound, but when push comes to shove, if I've got an IO around, I'm going to try and use that thing first. So we're going to talk about that quite a bit, because this device is used across age spectrums. I feel like we've been using it less in adults traditionally, but now I feel like we're using it more in adults in my shop, just because with children, it's a little more of that barrier to cross, although some places use it a lot more in kids because it's so easy and so quick to use. But you know, it's great because we can deliver fluids and medications and blood all through this. And there's very few true contraindications, and rarely do we actually run across complications. And most of the time, the complications are self-limiting in nature. So let's talk about the contraindications first. Well, obviously, you don't want to inject this thing into an area where there's an infection, fracture of the bone being used, or potentially proximally from the bone being used, are some other important factors to keep in mind. And this is all about blood flow and making sure that we're actually getting it to the source. The skin infection, of course, has its own risk. If you have an overlying infection and now you're introducing a needle, and it's the same thing that they tell us with using IVs, of any kind, is that anytime we cannulate through that, we're potentially introducing infection directly into the blood vessels, which definitely is not a good idea. The other things we need to watch for are severe bone disease, like osteogenesis imperfecta or osteoporosis or osteomyelitis of the bone that's involved. All those things are bad things. We really shouldn't be poking holes in them. Also, we need to watch for if there's any existing compartment syndrome to that area. Certain prior surgeries we need to watch for, burns to the areas as well, or any recent failed attempts at that same bone. Again, we should be cautious with this. The complications when we're talking about this, the big one's compartment syndrome. If you already have compartment syndrome in area, that's another good reason why not do it. But the main reason why we experience this compartment syndrome is due to the fluid extravasating from the actual site. So basically, and I've seen this happen before, people inject the IO, they push the fluids in. Somehow, even though we secured it properly, the IO wiggles its way out and is no longer seated in the bone. So what happens? Well, the fluid's got to go somewhere that you're pressure bagging in. It goes into the surrounding tissue. Is this a major issue? Most of the time, you're going to catch it early enough. It's not really going to be a big problem, but it still is something that you need to catch because compartment syndrome is still an issue. So most of the time, you're going to catch this early enough. It's going to be okay. But it is definitely when you're giving reports somewhere, if you're transferring this patient on and they've got some fluid extravasation, you're worried about potential early compartment syndrome, to let them know that so they're not surprised by this as well. Obviously, other potential complications include like skin infections or osteomyelitis or stuff like that. Very, very rarely, there have been complications up to death. It's usually due to the sternal access point, and that's with injuries of the heart and the aorta. Mediastinitis is another potential complication that's been seen with some of the older devices. The other one that people talk about are fat emboli. This has been questioned, though. Actually, there was kind of some neat animal studies where they found animals both with and without IO devices that were in cardiac arrest and had fat emboli. So the question is, did the fat emboli happen for other reasons, you know, rib and sternal fractures because of the CPR that was performed or stuff like that? So fat emboli, it's still worth knowing. It's still something that you could be quizzed about. So know that answer, but realistically, the fat emboli one is a less certain cause. So when it comes to actually inserting these devices, for the most part, these are pretty straightforward. I really like the EZ-IO, and I have no financial interest in any of these, but the EZ-IO is incredibly easy to use and has a lot of approved sites. And there's been a lot of studies on these different approved sites. As you will know, when you look at the IO packaging, it will have several different pieces of paper in it. The main one that you're going to see is that it's going to have this nice little picture that shows a sternum with a circle, you know, cross through it. And basically it's telling you do not put in the sternum. That's one of the few sites where you do not put an IO. And they make sure to specifically mention that because, of course, again, there has been this history of using sternal IOs, but the EZ-IO is not one of them. So make sure you're not putting EZ-IOs there. Most commonly, people are putting it in the like tibial tuberosity type area, more at the tibial plateau or at the humeral head. But you can do this all over. You can do this proximal. You can do this distal on tibia. You can do this at the distal femur I've seen before, distal radius. Like there's all sorts of sites that you can use it in. Now, given some sites are less investigated than others, but it's worth keeping this in mind if your traditional sites are not available for all sorts of different causes. The five signs that indicate proper placement are loss of resistance on entering the marrow cavity, the ability of the needle to remain upright without support, bone marrow or blood easily sampled using a syringe, the administration of 2 mLs of saline without tissue swelling, and easy administration of 8 mLs of saline without resistance. We'll try and include these graphs as well in the show notes about the different kind of things here because there are going to be a few different things along those lines. The other thing that comes up, and this is the one that really prompted this conversation, but I felt like we should just talk about IOs in general just so everyone's up to date and on the same page. It's about drawing blood through the IO. So this is possible, and this is something that you can easily do. But there's been a lot of question about the accuracy of drawing blood through an IO versus what you draw through an arterial or venous line. So there have been a couple of studies that we're going to specifically talk about, one in 2010 and the other in 2017 that we're going to talk about here in a minute, where they did a correlation of labs between the IO, and it was actually interesting. They drew the IO twice in both studies, the initial and then after some wasting, which I found, you know, kind of intriguing. There were slight differences in them, but usually not a lot. So I feel like you can just draw the blood straight from in most cases, just understanding again that there are some limitations, and these studies are both very small. But in the 2010 study, they found that the RBC, hemoglobin and hematocrit counts in the CBC were in the same, both in the venous and IO blood, but the white blood cells and platelets did not correlate. Also, glucose, the BUN, creatinine, chloride, total protein, and albumin in the chemistry profile were all well correlated, but sodium, potassium, CO2 and calcium concentrations were not. Again, these make sense when we think about it. The sodium was within 5%, calcium was within 10%, and the rest of the labs were within 25% correlation of the venous blood samples. However, we have to keep in mind that there are some other differences that do have a little bit of correlation with them. So the WBCs are going to be higher in the IO levels compared to the IV levels. CO2 and platelets are going to be lower in the IO compared to the IV. And we have to remember that this study was incredibly small. It only had 10 healthy volunteers. They drew all the blood from the humeral site, and it could change depending on other sites. It's something to keep in mind. It's also unknown if the lower CO2 level would have changed with evaluation of arterial blood, which actually leads very nicely to the 2017 study, where they did point-of-care analysis to find agreement between the IO and arterial blood. And that's how they studied it, but they also studied venous blood in this as well. So they did IO and the waist, arterial and venous blood samples. And they did it with both the EZ-IO, like the last one, and they did it with iStat devices, another commercial product. Again, no interest in that one either, but that's what they use for their point-of-care testing system. Like the previous study, the IO found some kind of interesting results. They're very similar, except for potassium and hemoglobin were slightly different. And you can see the show notes for the paper, because the paper is FOMED. It's free and open access, where you can review it all and see the slight differences amongst them. But otherwise, in this study, there were 31 healthy participants, which is definitely better. And they found that the potassium levels were found consistently elevated compared to the peripheral blood. Okay, so at least we're seeing a trend in a certain direction. And sodium and ionized calcium were also slightly lower. However, the IO samples demonstrated a higher result for base excess and bicarbonate. And then CO2 and O2 levels for the IO fell between the arterial and the venous samples. So in response to the question above, where they found the lower CO2 sample, at least in this, it looks like, yeah, you know, the CO2 and the O2 levels are going to be somewhere between that arterial and venous blood sample. So it could be somewhat accurate there, and it's still worth keeping in mind. Otherwise, the rest of the labs, the hemoglobin, hematocrit, glucose, and lactate were all in good agreement between the arterial and venous blood as well with the IO blood. Again, these samples are very small, and something that we didn't talk about with either one of these studies, but we have to keep in mind that patients who are critically ill could have deranged labs, where maybe the blood is in the bone is going to have different values than the arterial and venous blood would otherwise with healthy volunteers versus critically ill patients. So it may be worth, I think, still doing some further studies where they do critically ill patients and try to compare the blood samples there between arterial, venous, and IO to see what that shows. I think if we could do that, this would take everything to a whole new level and would give us some more understanding. But at least at this point, we can understand, yes, there are going to be some differences in the labs, but overall, we can use IO blood for testing, we just have to understand that we can't rely on all the labs accurately, such as the white blood cell count, for example, or platelets or CO2 or stuff like that. Maybe the CO2 isn't completely horrible because they'll fall between the arterial and venous samples, but we need to know those subtle but very important differences when we put this all together. So in the end, I really like how we do this. And after you get your IO placed, you know, you can secure it after you get some blood off it. And what I like to do is usually I insert it, I secure it. In the process of I'm getting blood and sampling off, if it doesn't look like we're going to get blood anywhere else in the near future, which usually we can, but I like to still draw it and have a separate label that this is from an IO versus a peripheral sample. And then I make sure to secure it. It's incredibly important. On the EZ-IO, they actually have a commercial securing device. I really like it. I feel like it is an easy one to work with. But again, with whatever you're using at your shop, you need to have some way to safely secure these things. When you remove it, it's actually fairly straightforward. You use like a Luralock syringe and you connect it to the hub, and then you just rotate it clockwise while you're pulling it out. It allows for an easier grip when you have the saline lock syringe, the Luralock syringes. And I feel like, again, it was pretty easy to take out. I have my students learn how to do that too, because it's really not that different than taking out an IV, the way you cover it back up with the sterile dressing and stuff like that. Really, this was meant to be a quick topic. I feel like we got to talk about a lot of different things. Again, if you have not been to practicalpocus.com, please check it out. I would love to see you guys at an upcoming ultrasound course. And if you can't make it to these upcoming courses in Missouri, that's totally fine. If we can't see you in Missouri, we can always come to your institution, or you can wait until we have another open registration course. But it's great if we can go around, teach people on their machines at their facilities. That's the way we like to do it best. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.